Generations upon generations have propagated the social moray that religion is a taboo topic and should never be broached in public. Well, some say abiding by this, we seem to have lost the ability to have civil public discourse. Hello, I'm Tika Ballas, and this is Hometown Alaska. Today is the second of a two-part series on God in Alaska. This show parallels the PBS series God in America, which started last Monday and finishes tonight on KAKM Channel 7. This two-part series is not meant to define and discuss all of the different religions and faiths practiced in the state, but rather to inspire the social discourse and to briefly touch on the different aspects of God in Alaska. Last week, we discussed the spirituality and way of life of Alaska Natives prior to the introduction of missionaries and the arrival of the Russian Orthodox Church. For the first part of today's show, we will be speaking about when other Western faiths arrived in Alaska and how they were dispersed. Speaking with us will be Dr. Kristen Helwig Hansen, a professor of philosophy and religion at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Dr. Hansen's research has included the Lutheran Church and Covenant Church presence in the Seward Peninsula and in the Norton Sound region. And in the second part of today's program, we will be introducing where religion is today in Alaska with Dr. Greg Kimura. Again, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today's show is the last of a two-part series titled God in Alaska, the history of faith in the Great Land and where it is today. If you would like to join the conversation, we'll start taking calls in just a bit at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Joining us today is Dr. Kristen Helwig Hansen. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Hello.
Just to start this off, of course, last week we were in the discussion about the introduction of the Russian Orthodox missionaries. But sometime after that, other denominations arrived, and first was the Presbyterian missionaries. And that is largely due to one man by the name of Sheldon Jackson, correct?
It is.
And Jackson is hailed by some as a very successful and accomplished man who did a phenomenal job of introducing Christian faith to the Alaskan natives. Some of his practices were different than the missionaries of the Lower 48. Can you discuss with us just a little bit of what his practices were here?
Actually, he was a very colorful character, an amazing grant writer. You cannot talk about what he did without talking about his involvement with government. I think that alone sets him apart from most missionaries. It's probably easier to start chronologically and look a little bit at who he was before he came. He arrived in Alaska without permission from his denomination. He was told to stay in the Rocky Mountain region. He was already a very colorful character because he wanted to be a foreign missionary, and he was refused because of health. So he became a home missionary for the Presbyterian Church. Home missions were to be supporting churches, establishing churches as already existing believers moved west. Foreign missions was in charge of, obviously, foreign countries, but also Native American conversions. So here he is, very interested in something that he's not even supposed to be working on.
And that's the home missions were not to be dealing with the Native.
Correct. Okay. And so he was told to stay home and particularly start working in Montana and other areas. And instead, he found his way to Portland, Oregon. And here, again, is an aspect of the man. So you mentioned the breadth of opinions. Within some circles, they would point out that he was very self-aggrandizing. A Portland minister had actually arranged for a widow to come up to Wrangell, Alaska, to take over a small cluster of Native American people that had wanted to establish a group. And Sheldon Jackson basically came with her, but his name is the name we remember. So he arrived in 1878 with Mrs. McFarlane up in Wrangell. She stayed in Wrangell and continued to work on a school and then soon a home. He went back and started raising funds, which was also not in his job description. He also started to lobby Washington, and so then we see this pattern of him visiting Alaska in the summer and working in Washington, D.C. or other places for the rest of the year.
So his first missionary then would technically be in Mount Wrangell?
that's the first place he landed in Alaska. Then he came back, so that would have been 1878. In 1879, he came back and he went up into the area we now know as Haines, which is named after one of his key supporters, I will add. And then in 1880, he published his very famous book, The Alaska. And there's a great contrast between what he said in that book and what he would say in the year, same year, to government committees. Also that year is the year where the critical introduction happened of other denominations. So he realized at that point that Alaska was too large for the Presbyterian Church to missionize the entire region. So it was in 1880 that he invited the Episcopalians, and he suggested they take the Yukon River area, and then the Baptists, and they were given Kodiak and the Cook Inlet region, Methodists at Aleutian Islands, Moravians, the Kuskokwim, Anishinaabeg River areas, Congregationalists got the Northwest Coast, and Presbyterians, Southeast Alaska and Point Barrow. Point Barrow is interesting. A school was supported there by a Louise Vanderbilt shepherd. So, again, highlighting one of his other great skills, which was fundraising, especially using wealthy women.
Clever. It wasn't part of the reasoning, too, as you mentioned briefly, that he realized that it couldn't only be the Presbyterian Church to set up their missions here. What, didn't that have something to do, too, with his financing that he was getting from the federal government to open up the schools?
That hadn't happened yet, but it's going to happen about 5 years later. And he will, there's going to be debate going on in the lower 48 whether the money appropriated for Native education is going to apply to Alaskans. And the Indian commissioners, it seemed as if the majority had tacitly assumed the bulk of the funds would come to Alaska. But there was one commissioner who pointed out that this wasn't explicitly stated, and he thought the money should be reappropriated. He carried the day. So there were not funds set aside, or the same funds could not be used for Alaska Natives that had been set aside for Indian education elsewhere.
Now, as I understand, there was not necessarily a fiscal appropriation, but there had been some mandating from the federal government that once Jackson became the federal superintendent, is that correct?
He becomes the superintendent of education.
Of education, that there had to be schools for both Native and non-Native students. How is that different? I mean, in the sense that the monies being appropriated to schools, how did they divide what monies went to which schools?
This is where his use of the churches was particularly helpful, actually. He was given only $22,000, which I know that was worth more in those days, but at the same time, that's not a lot, to work in the entire state when the position first started. It was not clear how that, whether that was for settlers or whether that was for the Native populations. There was a deeply entrenched racism, and so he did end up in some locations actually having two different schools, one for white students and one for Native students.
So they weren't necessarily integrated. That would, of course, cost more money then.
To have separate schools.
Yeah.
But if you convince the churches of the mission to Alaska Native people, then the churches step up and underwrite the schools to the Alaska Native students. And so we, in Alaska, received more dollars than had been allocated by the federal budget.
Because of the missionaries?
Yes.
And was that Sheldon Jackson's idea, or?
In part, and he was an exceptional fundraiser. And so he would, one source talks about 900 lectures, which in today's world, 900 lectures or presentations in a six-year period is probably not that remarkable. But if you think of transportation in those days, that is quite remarkable. And he would use letters from the mission fields, present the plight, as he would depict it, and was extremely successful in getting extra financial resources. Part of the resources were the missionaries themselves as teachers, and of course, this is where different versions of the stories appear. But he felt that the missionary personality was the only one who would be willing to come for such a low price to remote areas, difficult life, and stay. He wasn't wrong about turnover. That continues to be a problem for rural Alaskan education, is keeping teachers, but missionaries coming with different or additional agenda to just education. They were pretty dedicated people.
So the turnover isn't quite as high with the missionaries.
Was not as high with the missionaries.
Is that still the case today?
I haven't checked in on that. I'm not aware of where missionaries are running schools. In where I shared with the population, but I would say that the commitment and the interest on the basis of friendship now probably as much or more, but there is a different motivation or an increased motivation. It's, you're certainly not going, they were not going to get funds to be wealthy. You weren't going to remote Alaska to get wealthy as a missionary teacher.
Yeah, Tika, I think there are. This is Greg Kimura here. I think there are a couple of really important observations out of what Dr. Hansen has talked about here, and I think we need to abstract a little bit from the historical, or actually, invest ourselves in the historical perspective here, and understand that Alaska, as it is today, but even more so back then, there just was very little infrastructure. We think it's difficult to get from Point Hope to Barrow to Fort Yukon to Petersburg today. Imagine how this was back then. For all of his the criticisms and shortcomings, and there are many, there are very, very many for Sheldon Jackson. He was in some ways one of the more harsh missionaries that were out there outlying the speaking of English and so forth. He was a political savvy person, and he said, hey, what, this is a very Alaskan yes. attitude to have. What other infrastructure, what other organizations are operating in the state that have a parallel sort of mission to education? And this is the way Alaskans do anything in the state today anyway. We get nothing done unless we cooperate, collaborate with parallel institutions and organizations. So that's something that he identified early on, and I think is a strategy that every nonprofit, every state institution has inherited since that time. But the other thing is that nowadays this wouldn't happen because of the more clear delineation of separation of church and state. But also, speaking from somebody who is representative of a mainline Christian denomination, the resources are just not there mm-hmm. or are not being put forth by the churches to do missionary work. So in one sense, there was this brief historical period where there was a lot of money and a lot of enthusiasm by the mainline denominations to come to Alaska, and now those resources have all but dried up.
Mm-hmm. And, well, let's go back to the historical aspect. With, granted, $22,000 still was not a lot of resources, but in the implementation, or the distribution, rather, of different religions and denominations within the state, can we just go over those one more time? How that, was it four sectors, basically, that it was broken up into?
I find it more regional than that. It wasn't just a nice graph that way.
But again, this was a very politically savvy thing to do, okay? Sheldon Jackson got all the denominations together and said, hey, for the past 100 years, we've been fighting village by village, hamlet by hamlet, to missionize people across the West. Alaska's too big. The resources are spread too thin. The Catholics, why don't you, since you already have a bit of a historical purchase there, focus on the Southwest. Episcopalians have been coming since at least the mid-19th century via the Anglican Church through Canada along the Yukon River drainage. You guys have that spot now. The larger towns and cities, everybody had a presence there. But by and large, they divided the state into little quadrants.
How was that decision made, though? Like, who?
He actually pulled together a convention in 1880, invited representatives.
Wow.
And so it, in a time where ecumenical action wasn't occurring, this was really phenomenal.
And did they draw straws?
No, I think it was, as Greg pointed out, that there had been these patterns or natural. The one thing I would just say is he was pretty intentional in his exclusion of Catholics.
Yeah, and Judaism didn't come along with that either. That didn't come until
that was
like 50 years ago.
Well, that would not be the understanding for a Christian missionary of that time.
Right.
Those would not be related faiths.
Right. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing God in Alaska. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can shoot us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org. And right now we are discussing Sheldon Jackson and his distribution of different denominations throughout the state.
You asked before about key differences or what did he do differently. Something that I do think was unique is that half his salary in this job as the head of the education was that half his salary was paid by the Presbyterian Board of Home Mission, and the other half was paid by the federal government. So we probably would never see that arrangement again.
No. And it's interesting that he, if you look up Sheldon Jackson, he is equally admonished and demonized.
I would actually two things I would like to bring forward on that. One is an unpublished voice. So you're right, the published voices go all over the place. But a person that was helping me when I was doing field research shared an unsolicited comment from her father, who had actually he obviously was deceased at this time, but had experience with schools both under the BEA and under the BIA. And he said that the education under the BEA, he thought, was much stronger. So I found that interesting. I didn't elaborate. You know, I was getting it secondhand. But I think that's important to hold up, that here is a central Yupik voice who was there and did know and did feel that there quality education had been delivered.
Well, one of the things I did notice in my readings of Sheldon Jackson or about him was one of the things that was pointed out that was different about his methods to those in the lower 48 dealing with the native peoples of that area, was that he didn't believe in taking them away from their homes, the children.
That's, I don't really understand where that comment would be coming from. First of all, he was not in the state personally doing much very often, but he did help raise the funds for a residential school there in Wrangell for young women. It was a big discussion, very dramatic discussion.
Dramatic how so?
When you read Alaska, it's been a while, but I think we even have dramatic scenes where someone is dismembered on the beach, shamans chasing after people. Mrs. McFarland would write letters about the young girls being sold into slavery, and the more she educated them, the more appealing they were to these immoral trappers and hunters, and so they were going to be sold into prostitution. And through these kinds of stories, these were the stories that would then get presented to the executive committees of the auxiliaries, and they would raise funds so that a home could be established so these young women could leave their homes and live in safety with Mrs. McFarland or within the school. I don't think, I'm surprised by that characterization of Jackson, that he wouldn't have supported that. I wouldn't have come to that same conclusion.
Yeah, there are just a couple of papers out there that state that he... the difference, he was very much for the acculturation and elimination of native tongues, but that he wasn't really big on creating boarding schools far away. But again, I've seen other things that say contradictory. Again, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing God in Alaska. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so at 550-8433, or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. And right now we're discussing Sheldon Jackson and his distribution of faith around the state. And my curiosity is how much, is there still a remnant of what he set up originally, and to what degree?
I think it's very strong. I mean, the church that was first there is usually still remembered and may or may not still have a presence. In some places, some of the elders, and when I use that term, they're now people in their 70s and 80s, so they would have been obviously not involved with the first contact. At the same time, for example, in the interior, the Episcopal Church is considered their church, and they've been a bit upset when, say, some of the newer charismatic churches have come in, and in part having a second church or a second denomination in the village destabilizes the sense of unity and sharing and what the church was valued for. The original is there, and some of the more recent developments that perhaps from a white society point of view increases choice, from a more traditional view, is undercutting community.
Again, you are listening to Hometown Alaska, and we're discussing God in Alaska. We've been speaking predominantly with Dr. Kristen Hansen, Professor of Philosophy and Religion at UAA. Next, we'll be speaking predominantly with Dr. Greg Kimura, President and CEO of the Alaska Humanities Forum. We'll be back after this break.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today is the second part of a two-part series titled God in Alaska. I would like to impress upon my listeners that in no way is this two-part series meant to cover everything regarding spirituality, faith, and religion in the Great Land, nor all different beliefs. This is merely meant to inspire a public discourse and an illumination of some of the different aspects regarding the topic of God in Alaska. Our next guest is Dr. Greg Kimura. He is a fourth-generation Alaskan and holds degrees in philosophy and constructive theology from Marquette University and Harvard Divinity School, as well as a PhD in philosophy of religion from Cambridge University. His book, Neo-Pragmatism and Theological Reason, was published in 2007. He is also the editor of Alaska at 50 and was awarded the 2010 Pathfinder Award by the Alaska Historical Society. Dr. Kimura is formerly university chaplain, assistant professor, and chairman.
It's just easier to say that I'm a jack of all trades.
He is a jack of all trades. He's also presently the president and CEO of the Alaska Humanities Forum. Good to have you here with us.
It's nice to be here, Tika, and to talk about the history of religion in the state. Religious faith, and then to kind of mirror this national PBS series that's going on right now, and hopefully to develop a local conversation to go along with this larger civil discourse on the impact of religion in the U.S.
And in fact, on our website, if you go to kska.org under Hometown Alaska, we have a list of all kinds of links if you're interested in finding out public discourse on religion, whether it's nationwide or here localized in Alaska. And again, that's on kska.org. Now, we've just been discussing, and you jumped in at a really great point earlier in the conversation, about the distribution of denominations in the state. Now, it's 2010, and the Pew Foundation just released some interesting numbers based on four indices of religiosity. And one of them is the importance of religion in people's lives, the frequency of attendance at worship services, the frequency of prayer, and certainty of belief in God. Now, according to the Pew Foundation's research, Mississippi came out at the top of the list at 60%, and Alaska is at the very bottom of the list at 22%.
Once again, we make the bottom of the list.
We make the bottom of the list, the biggest state in the bottom of the list.
Well, first of all, let me say, and I was joking about this earlier, I think you have to take a look at the Pew Forum's research in this with a bit of a jaded attitude. I mean, what is that they say about statistics and lies?
Right.
Well, I think that when people are asked questions about their religiosity, about their faith, they may tend to exaggerate a little bit. There's no way. I've taken a look at the research there on the Pew Center's website when they speak about things such as regular church attendance. I don't believe that 44% or up to 60% of people in Mississippi attend a worship service every week. And I don't even think that 22% of Alaskans.
So you think we're even below the bottom of the list?
I know we're below 22% as far as weekly attendance is concerned. There are more people who are watching the NFL on Saturday morning that are attending church services. In the summertime, there are more people on the Kenai River than there are in the churches on the Kenai Peninsula. So, this are all anecdotal, but I do think that there is some exaggeration. Now, as far as general trends are concerned, I think it's probably correct that there is less formal affiliation with denominations by people in Alaska. And coming in second and third to last were New Hampshire and Vermont. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about being a bit more remote, a bit more rural, about having a younger population, about having a more transient population, that all contributes to that mix. And also, let's face it, Alaska tends to we're a bunch of cantankerous, independent thinkers, or at least we like to believe that we are. But there's a certain kernel of truth there. We have more people who may be less officially affiliated with a denomination, but I think we do have quite a high number of folks who are seeking or open or interested in a variety of different religions and religious experiences.
Now, when I mentioned the Pew Foundation's numbers, and even though those are debatable, people still seem here in the state relatively surprised. And I think because we see areas, pockets of the state that have a good portion of the population, well, maybe not necessarily a good portion, but there are more churches that are obvious to the eye, what they call Church Alley in Wasilla. I don't actually know of Church Alley, but I've just heard it said.
You can say that Church Alley is every other street in every town in the state. Mm-hmm. If you throw a rock, you're going to hit a church, whether it's a freestanding church structure or it's a storefront operation, or a home church or something like that. So it seems as though we have more places of worship than anything else in the state sometimes. But on paper, there are fewer people going to those churches or officially affiliated with those churches. And it's not just churches. It's increasingly other religions as well, houses of worship too.
Well, the Pew Foundation is basing that number off of four different indices, and among those are also inclusive of a stalwart belief that there is a God, right? So do you think that number is different as well? Do you think that there's still just a really low fraction of this population that believes in God?
Well, I think probably the biggest, I'm not a statistician, but, mm-hmm. If you slice and dice the numbers a certain way, I think the number one factor that's giving us a lower number than elsewhere would be our relatively younger population. And it is almost a universal, not just across denominations, but across different religions, that there is, when you're younger, you tend to be taken off sometimes, as I was, kicking and screaming, to Sunday school, and then you fall away during your teen and young adult years, and then you have kids and start coming back, and then you bring your kids and come back to get married and baptize your kids and so forth. And by the time you hit late middle age, you know, the numbers rise to over half of the population. So I think that's one of the things as well. But there's a further nationwide trend, and that is beginning with Generation X. That's the generation born between 1964 and 1980, and then Generation Y, or the quote-unquote millennial generation, that was born between 84 and 2000. These are the first two generations born in the United States that have had more of their people raised outside an official faith than within. So a sort of a line has been crossed here, and amongst the things that come with that are people not knowing what church to go to, or not having a basic understanding of theological beliefs, because they, you know, weren't forced to memorize Bible verses or the order of the books in the New Testament, things like that, or the foundational biblical stories and so forth.
Do you think that this could possibly attest to why in other studies I've been reading recently, how so many people who claim they are of a faith but can't answer very specific, or not even very specific, details about the Bible of which they adhere to?
Well, see, that's another one that did you see in the Anchorage Daily News? I mean, this ran, of course, a week ago in the New York Times, in the same study about religious literacy, if you can call it, use that term, but asking certain what they call quote-unquote basic questions. Now, I have a PhD in philosophy of religion. I will tell you that if I went by what ran in the Anchorage Daily News, that little test, I would have gotten a couple of them wrong, all right? That test, if you take a look at it, it's really designed to kind of trick people, you know? It's to play off of what they think a religion believes and then to kind of reverse the answer there. And the message of that whole study is really, you know, how much the world's major religions have in common. And I think that's really the upshot of that study. And it makes for good copy in the newspaper and things like that. But overall, you know, I don't doubt that there's a very poor religious literacy in this country, as there's a poor historical literacy, or a poor numeracy, or heck, for that matter, a literacy. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't read too much into that particular study. For example, I mean, one of the side facts that came out of it was that people who claim to be atheists have a higher score, generally have a higher score than people who claim to have a religious affiliation do. You know, it's cute, it's somewhat interesting, but I don't really think it tells you a whole lot more than we already know.
If you're just listening, or just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing God in Alaska. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or email us at hometownalaska@ksKA.org. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Oh, hi. I was wondering when Sheldon Jackson was divvying up the state, what's the historical record show about how come the Russian Orthodox Church was not included, or was it even discussed asking them, or was there a presence here in Alaska at that time?
There was I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There was all, this is Kristen Helwig Hansen, there was already a very strong presence, but no, Jackson, first of all, the basis would have been in a foreign country to Sheldon Jackson, and it looked to, he probably would have used the word Popist to him, like with the Roman Catholic Church, he would have not intentionally incorporated them in his invitation. Also, we do see ongoing stories. I think Dr. Alexa pointed those out, if not in the broadcast he does in his book, the tensions that did start to develop between the Orthodox faith and the Presbyterian faith in Southeast settings, actually questions about kidnapping children and things like this.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for your call, Jill.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And while we're just spin back into history a little bit, we have a question here from Walt. Good afternoon, Walt.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I had a reference that I thought might be of interest to your readership. I'm a retired United Methodist minister, and way back when, in 1967, when we celebrated the purchase of Alaska from Russia, the Alaska Council of Churches commissioned the author Tay Thomas to write a book about the impact that pioneer missionaries had had in shaping Alaska's destiny. That little book was called Cry in the Wilderness, and we sold 5,000 copies of it and probably should reprint it. But the reason I'm calling, in conjunction with that book, we commissioned a mural by the well-known artist Rhee Munoz of Juneau, and the benefactors were Elmer and Mary Louise Rasmussen. And that mural in art depicts what Tay said in her book. It has 17 sections, and it has the great pioneer missionaries depicted, S. Howell Young, Sheldon Jackson, even Evangeline Booth of the Salvation Army, Bishop Veniaminoff, Bishop Cremant, Dr. Joseph Roemig, the famous Moravian physician who ministered in the Kuskokwim. And that mural now hangs in the Rasmussen Library at the University of Alaska. It's 12 feet long, 6 feet high, full oils. It's absolutely glorious. And it's an important part of Alaska's history, and I wanted your listeners to know about it.
Well, thank you, Walt. And, you know, having gone to UAA myself, and I've seen that mural, I have to embarrassingly enough admit I had no idea.
It's at UAF.
It's at UAF.
Oh, it is at UAF. There is a beautiful mural over at UAF. I'm glad to know that that's not the pioneer missionary. I totally misinterpreted it then.
This is... was very carefully rendered by Rhee, who's one of Alaska's best-known artists. And there's Mary Winchell with the children at the Jesse Lee Home, and Tilly Paul, who translated the Bible into Tlingit, and Tolik Brevik, who ministered with the Lutheran Church in the Arctic. And it's just, and even some famous people like John Muir appeared along the side of S. Hall Young. And it sort of is a great sweep of history celebrating that remarkable way that the pioneer missionaries helped shape Alaska's destiny. And it's there at the Rasmussen Library, and it's well worth a visit because it really does encapsulate this phenomenal impact that the church had in at that pivotal time in history.
Great. Thank you, Walt.
You're welcome.
Interestingly, he says how it shaped our religious destiny. And here we are talking about back into the present day, our religious destiny. We are been deemed, and not just by the Pew Foundation, but other studies have deemed us as like the least religiously inclined state. Mm. But do you foresee, either of you, do you foresee this staying this way? There seems to be such an influx of people coming here. Dr. Kimura?
Well, like I said, I'm not sure that we really are the least religious. I think that I think there's something deep within the human spirit that is looking for transcendence, that's looking for core values, that's searching for meaning. And so I think a lot of it just depends on what one defines as religion nowadays. You know, if you take a look at... there was another study that came out that showed that somewhere around 20% of people in the United States practice yoga regularly. Well, is that a spiritual practice, or is it just exercise? I think if you talk to a lot of people, like my wife who practices yoga, I mean, it's a little bit of both. So I think you need to include things like that. And I also think that increasingly, there was a very important article ran a few years ago in the Atlantic Monthly that talked about the rise of interest in nature and environmentalism, and I do believe that in Alaska, you know, we get out in the wilderness, we worship God in the cathedrals of glaciers outside. We recognize the holy in this the surroundings here, so majestic and so awe-inspiring. And I think that there is something to be said for the sort of communing with nature, to use that term, I imagine almost every Alaskan has this experience who gets out in the great outdoors. And I don't believe we can discount that either.
No, and I'd like to follow up on that. First, I think some of these questions are based on an assumption that religions don't change, and that the measure of Christianity will always be church attendance and Bible reading and whatever. And I don't have the vision to know, you know, where Christianity might go, but I think it would be a mistake to tie the faith to old forms of the practice of that faith. I also think what Greg was saying about the nature of Alaska and what it brings, if in our definition of religion, which everyone won't agree on what that is, but if it includes answering ultimate questions, you know, we have the highest accident rate for children that I think nationally. An amazing number of our kids have had to face the loss of a friend due to a natural accident. The care that you have to exercise, just being out in Alaska, what does death mean? What does life mean? What is beauty? Those are some of the classic questions. So I'm not sure that we know how to measure religion or spirituality. And I do know that the Christian conversation in the state is how do we better speak to the experiences that are here and not feel, not lose what is in those old traditions and forms, but at the same time not simply define ourselves by how Christianity has always been done in the past.
And one of the newer recognized beliefs is what they're calling, I think what you refer to as naturalism or naturalist.
Or nature religion.
Nature religion. And is that becoming more recognized around the world, or is that specific to places like Alaska?
It's certainly recognized in the American Academy of Religion. it seems to be growing up around sports, actually. So places where you have active sports, there are interesting articles from whitewater kayakers, one that sticks in my mind. And they basically are speaking to religion as an experience that then evokes an ethic. So that would be an interesting definition of religion.
And I think there's something that's very essentially and intrinsically American about this this sort of experience with nature. It goes back to Emerson crossing a Cambridge Common, where he talks about looking up and he becomes one with nature. The metaphor is a transparent eyeball. He looks up. The separation between him and the world out there is transparent, and he's kind of taken up in this ecstatic experience, so it may be, we may think these are also contemporary phenomena, but it's something that's very deeply rooted in the American experience of religious faith and the world around us.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and today we are discussing God in Alaska. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can, of course, email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. And it looks like we do have an email here, and it's from David Beckett. Let me reach over and do this. The leaders of the ELC... A, Bishop Michael Keyes, and Yukon Presbyterian, and Michael Burke, pastor of St. Mary's Episcopal, and I have been meeting regularly to explore how our Christian denominations can work together. We have agreed not to start a new church in a community without informing each other. We are working with Native leaders across the state to improve leadership training for Native lay pastors, and we are working on giving Alaska a Christian voice that is not Christian fundamentalism. We are talking about sharing pastors and more. For us, it is not about what divides us, but real ministry meeting real human needs. And that is David Beckett, the conference superintendent of the Alaska United Methodist Conference. And you're nodding your heads. You are familiar with this gentleman? And he says an interesting thing here about not to start a new church in a community. And Dr. Hansen and I discussed this at one point in time in the past about... villages that have historically had only one particular church within the village, and now we're starting to see more than one, and the division that's creating. Can you talk a little bit about that and what maybe he's discussing here as well, Dr. Beckett?
I hope I'm doing justice. He's talking about the competition of resource and this concern about what the denominational name is. And so I think there's much applauding that move to a larger Christian message and not be so tied to denominational label. What you and I were talking about, though, is I think part of the conversation of what does church membership mean for a Native person. And I'm obviously not the best person to talk about this, but what I was sharing was that there was this sense or this owning of the church, even if one was not an active attender. So this sense of coming from a Lutheran village or coming from an Episcopal village, and it seemed to become part of the root. It was a community force. People, church buildings often were a large building where the whole community could gather, and things happened there that build community. The praying together that was often a pre-existing spiritual practice. So praying wasn't foreign, but the large praying, maybe that was different. The singing together long been cherished, and here it is replicated in a different spiritual idiom, but similar with the connections that come through that. So the church functioning in that way, being of support to the communities, being of support to the values that mattered, that was valued. And when you suddenly start to have denominational infighting and bickering, that was seen as unfortunate. That kind of conflict wasn't helpful.
It does seem to undermine that idea of building up and maintaining community if you have in a small community a division of faiths, correct?
It would. I mean, just the simple choice. Where do you go when the service is being held? Or where does your time go or your resources?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon nowadays. I mean, Pastor David is a representative of a mainline denomination, and you mentioned the ELCA, which is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and the Episcopal Church USA as well, along with the United Methodist Church here, have all been very good about cooperating and collaborating. And this ecumenical agreements, basically not to poach each other's members. I think part of that also is a practical. It comes out of a practical need that all the mainline denominations are shrinking in membership. And some of the other denominations that may be coming into historically affiliated villages may not be what are quote-unquote mainline denominations. So there was a period of time during the 50s where some of the Baptist churches started coming into some of the villages. A little bit later was the Assembly of God that were coming into some of these. But I've been in places like Fort Yukon and Venati and places that are a little bit off the beaten path. And these are places that have been missionized and for 6, 7, 8 generations. I mean, longer than my family has been Christianized. And I think there's a certain there's a wonderful spiritual ability to inhabit two different worlds, to inhabit a world that is spirit-filled, that is enchanted, that comes out of indigenous spirituality, and to also claim equally and as part of the tradition an Orthodox Christianity as well. Dr. Hansen here is one, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the world's foremost experts on this, and I think this is going to be an increasing area of interest to academics, and not just to academics, but anybody who's interested in kind of what it takes to live and inhabit a world nowadays. We all sort of wear two hats nowadays. But I've been in some of these villages, and, you know, they are more traditional in their worship, you know, than some of the places on the East Coast that one might, you know, consider, you know, the upholders of an Anglo tradition. Still reading out of the 1928 Episcopal Prayer Book, in fact, even if it is, you know, translated into Koyukon, Athabascan, or Gwich'in. or even before that, the Canadian prayer books. So the ability to just to inhabit two worlds and to move freely between those two and to synthesize and incorporate something that is both native and Christian, it takes a type of genius.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the mainline denominations. You know, you can drive around and you'll see here and there churches that say non-denominational or don't seem to have any direct affiliation with a mainline denomination. Are we starting to see those in more rural areas as well, or are they still specifically mainline denominations, though?
Now, as Greg was saying, the Pentecostal denominations are the presence that I'm most aware of in
and those
the
are
villages.
Those are considered mainline, though.
No, they aren't.
Okay,
they're more recent. recent when you're looking at the long history. But
great to clear that up. Thank you. What would you consider some of these big, what some people call box churches that are starting to strike up? Are those considered mainline then, or?
They have independent governance is one of the things. Often that there isn't a national governance situation. So,
Specifically regional then, or?
Well, they have generally affiliations. You know, you'll find that a lot of the big box churches, quote unquote, will have a lot of the similar music. They may even have some of the same canned sermons that are borrowed and themes and so forth. But may not identify themselves with a particular denomination.
Now, those seem to be, at least in the lower 48, to be on the rise about like 10 years ago or so. Do either of you foresee this becoming more of a trend or less of a trend here in Alaska?
Some of our larger churches have done a tremendous job of filling some needs that may be unique to Alaska. We are without family. That means we're without childcare. We're without, easy connections. They have taken the time and the resources to address some of those needs, so that may continue to draw a lot of people. I guess I'm wanting to be real sure at this point that we don't get splintered here. Mm-hmm. Yes, they may not share the title mainline or whatever, but what isn't, they are obviously Christian, and they focus on Christian belief. So we're straying a little bit, I think, in that are they a sociologic phenomenon that's going to continue? Well, we could argue that both sides. I think maybe there are some pressures in Alaska that might drive them. But are we talking about a theological question here?
Well, let's look at it from the standpoint of what Greg said a minute ago about the Generation X. And how Generation X is like the first generation to really come along that wasn't really raised in a church, wasn't brought up with sermons. And are we finding perhaps, I know you're not a statistician, but are we finding that maybe the Generation X's, now that they are starting to have children, are starting to look for a religion? And would that box... I'm sorry, I don't know the proper term.
It started with the baby boomers who were raised in the church, but they just couldn't get away from it fast enough. Okay. And so their children were in large part raised a majority were raised outside of a particular faith. I think what you're seeing with some of these and clearly some of them don't even use the term church. You'll notice that a number of the the real big ones in Anchorage will call themselves something else, but their church will not be in there, or Christian won't be in there. It won't be in their name. It's as though they really want to separate. They're the ones that want to separate themselves from an affiliation or an association. That was how other denominations, quote unquote, did it. But we're something different. They're very effective in making an almost stadium or concert like appeal to people who may not have. A religious idiom. So they have great music, huge audiences and so forth. I do, on a sociological level, think that it's probably going to hit its peak at some point. From what I've seen, and this is an historical trend, is people tend to like smaller communities of worship. That's true in almost all the mainline denominations. I saw a really interesting statistic about the Episcopal Church, that something of somewhere around 80% of all the churches have less than 100 people attending every Sunday. And to some folks, that's the red lights are going off, the church is dying. But if you take a look at it another way, even at those larger stadium-like churches, people, if they go back for a second Sunday or a third Sunday, end up going to sort of the same area or section. So they see the same faces. Mm. People generally want in their worship, in their religious experience, familiarity. They want a sense of connection to community and to other people. And so over time, the huge worship services, I think, lose some of that power to actually keep and inspire people. And even within those large structures, they have, of course, smaller group pull-out groups and so forth that you can be a part of. And that's a recognition of this almost basic human need that we want to have intimacy and familiarity.
Well, I'm not going to even pretend that I have any of the answers on any of this, but I do think it's interesting to look at society in general, how we are more and more, there's a popular idea of going toward community and localizing smaller names, smaller business, whether it has anything to do with the environment or just community in general. And I can't help but wonder if we will start seeing a rise again of really small, community-oriented churches in places where we haven't seen them in a while.
I think we're seeing them already. That's the whole comment mm-hmm. about it seems like we're inundated, like everywhere. There's a church at every corner. Because that's not just something that's going to happen, it's something that's happening right now.
And what about, too, the idea, the Pew Foundation's study doesn't seem to include this, maybe it does, but the idea that there are also a lot of people who are not worshiping in a church, but I do know of several groups and denominations here in Anchorage that gather in homes. Do those come into the stats, do you think?
That, I think, just shows up as home church. So I think you're still church. What is more difficult to capture would be those people worshiping on the internet or, these very alternative forms. Something we haven't talked a lot about and is a reality is that some people have had very negative experiences with church, or they look back at this 1950s era and mm-hmm. see an artifice. It's not as if, and we're speaking about churches, but I suspect every faith community has periods or has spokespersons or something that, it's not your sterling moment. So again, this complicates the picture of what's really going on religiously and spiritually in an environment.
You nod your head.
I mean, the churches are composed of people with all the normal failings of everywhere else. It just seems much more focused when we hear bad news coming out of the churches, because the churches are supposed to be held to a higher standard and supposed to be beacons and so forth. That's what makes the failings all the more tragic.
Well, it's an interesting email that just came in, and we're just going to probably end on this note. But it says, it seems dishonest to label any attempt to look at deep experiences and ethical thought as religious, as it seems to rule out, by definition, a non-religious basis for ethics. This was sent by somebody's BlackBerry. But this is an interesting way to start to end this conversation here. And is it, in fact, unethical to discuss it on that end?
Well, I would just put in one little bit. Church attendance, unfortunately, is often tied to people hoping that the church is going to do moral inculcation, that their kids won't abuse substances and won't have sex. And so sometimes you are looking for canned morality or...
It looks like we've come to our end. I want to thank our guests, and sorry to cut it all off so quick. It's a conversation that can go on quite a while. Again, Dr. Kristen Hansen, Professor of Philosophy and Religion at UAA, Dr. Greg Kimura, President and CEO of Alaska Humanities Forum. This show parallels PBS series God in America that ends tonight on KAKM Channel 7. Next week, stay tuned for Kathleen McCoy, who will be talking with the cast of Mamma Mia, and Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Speck engineered today's program with assistance from Josh Edge, and thank you for listening. I'm Tika Ballas.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.